Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingenstein. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingenstein with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. If you're new to our podcast, welcome. Encourage you to go back and listen to some of our previous guests. We've had some great guests over the last several years, and encourage you to leave a review and share this podcast with others. This week, we're going to have, for the second time, a guest join us. His name's David Dennis, and David is the President and Chief Executive Officer of Eckerd Connects, which is one of the nation's largest nonprofits. They provide workforce development, Job Corps, juvenile justice, and child welfare services across the country. And we're going to be talking about his book entitled Gameness, Land on Your Feet, Not on Your Feelings. He has a great personal story. He's going to share just some things that he's learned as he's led organizations through growth. Looking forward to today's conversation with David. It's great to have someone who's been on a podcast a number of episodes ago. We were just talking that you were episodes 31 and 32, and we're up in the 270s now. Appreciate you coming back on our podcast, David.
Well, I'm honored to be asked, and congrats on the success of your podcast. I'm sure it's been a great value to those that follow you and listen, and a lot of lessons to be learned from leaders you've interviewed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, since we last spoke, a lot has happened in your life, and maybe give us just a little bit of an overview over your career and just kind of how you've gotten to where you are today. And we're going to be talking about a book that you wrote a while back, and would love to get, first of all, your kind of your life story in a few minutes.
Yeah, well, I'll try to make this quick because I'm really old. that's a lot of life ground to cover, Mark. I think real quickly, by the age of five, you know my story, Mark, but by the age of five, I learned one of life's most important lessons, and that is that life is uncertain, unfair, and oftentimes unpleasant. And so that's a great lesson to learn because it shapes your thinking and your attitude about a lot of things. And it was a great, great lesson for me. For me, it was a very painful way of learning that. Lost my dad when I was almost four. For the next year or so, my sister and I's mom really struggled and eventually cratered under the weight of alcoholism and her efforts to provide for us and care for us. And we were removed from her custody and ultimately her authority by Child Protective Services, placed in separate homes. And then about a year into that journey, we got reunited by another family after we'd been removed, raised by the same family, and got a second chance that a lot of kids who went through what we went through, you know, don't get. So, but that for me was, even though at that time I wouldn't have, you know, understood what I understand now looking back, but the perspective now that I have looking back is that it really did shape a lot of who I ultimately became. And one of those things that how it shaped me was, once I rebelled as a teenager and made some really poor decisions. And a couple of years out of high school, I had a real spiritual turnaround in my life, just out of desperation, looking for answers after I'd tried everything else, started reading the Bible. And that really gave me a compass and kind of a true north for my life. And out of that, once kind of my heart was in a different place, I really just wanted to find kids and families that were going through what I went through as a kid and help them to the best of my ability not go through that. So I started volunteering as a big brother in a shelter, a youth shelter and a nonprofit. While I was in college, volunteered at my church too and youth ministry. And over the next few years, really discovered that my calling and my path was not to be in vocational ministry, I really, really felt like I was supposed to be out kind of in the market, in the world, in the community, working with families that often, frankly, aren't showing up at church. A lot of the young people I've worked with or have headed down antisocial paths. And I've worked with a lot of at-risk youth over the years, and kids in the juvenile justice system, kids in the child welfare system, foster care, but also kids that are just deeply impoverished and living marginalized lives. And so that eventually led me to going to graduate school, getting my master's in counseling, and then, you know, working directly as a counselor professionally with these young people. Eventually, long story short, I ended up being asked to take on a leadership role in my life, which I, you know, said no to a number of years. I just never saw myself in that seat. But I had a boss that was pretty relentless and continued to press me that that was, he felt like, where I belonged and that I was a leader. And circumstances changed. Two kids, a third one on the way. My wife, Becky, and I talked. She really wanted to be home with our kids. I needed to make more money, and I couldn't do the casework during the case manager during the day and counsel at night. So I took a job as a manager of a program. And long story short, from there to here, I kept getting asked to take on larger scope of responsibilities, larger organizations. And I came here about 18 years ago to this nonprofit, Eckerd Connects. And our primary focus when I came was really working with kids that were engaged in the juvenile justice system, child welfare system. And about 10 or 11 years ago, after spending my entire career working primarily with that population, and you know, the first 8 to 10 years here doing the same, I started really giving a lot of thought to how frustrating it was to see kids generationally continue in the foster care system. You know, there many times there would be a kid in the system whose mom or dad and or grandparents had been in the foster care system or in the welfare system. Same way with the juvenile justice system. So that I started looking at some data back then and saw that year that about 52% of the new inmates in Florida prisons had already been touched in some way before they got there by the Florida juvenile justice system. I started looking at the population of young people in the juvenile justice system and began to realize that probably half of the older teens in the foster care system had some brush with the justice system in juvenile justice or arrest or some similar path. And I just started thinking, wow, here's this pathway to prison, you know, beginning with families coming apart for all kinds of reasons, ending up in the welfare system, then being adjudicated in the justice system, and then on into prison. And so as I began to think about that and look at it, I thought, well, where were they before foster care and the welfare system? And so when you look at the population of people in prison, juvenile justice, child welfare, foster care, probably 90% of them come from the same place, and it's poverty. So we decided to what we call, we kind of gave it a name, moving upstream, and began to focus on trying to identify those families that were you know, really entrapped in poverty and living out that desperation and all the subsequent things that can come out of that, you know, anger, substance abuse, domestic violence, kids being removed, going to the child welfare system, kids feeling worthless and lost and choosing antisocial pathways. And so we really got committed to focus on helping help people build a pathway out of poverty through employment, help them discover their gifts and talents and purpose in life. And so that's what we've been focused on now for over 10 years. And it's been an incredible journey doing that. So that's kind of a short story of my career path and how I got here. And I've been the CEO here for 18 years.
Well, your story is definitely inspiring. And I know one of your goals is to give back to the next generation of leaders and to help people grow and develop. Talk a little bit about your book. I've got several questions around it, but it's the title is Gameness, Land on Your Feet, Not on Your Feelings. First off, can you give us just a little bit of the background of the reason you wrote the book, and what do you mean by gameness?
Yeah, I never got to have a conversation with my dad that I remember, my biological dad, and that always left a pretty big hole in me. I always kind of longed for, you know, I wish I could remember what his voice sounded like. I have some fleeting memories of him, but certainly no conversations where I got to ever hear him talk up stories about lessons he had learned or give me any advice or, you know, and that's something I kind of longed for. And as I was thinking about that one day, I thought, you know, I want to leave something behind for my kids that after I'm gone, kind of that as I told them, the conversation I never got to have with my dad, and really with my mom either, because she was, you know, so far, you know, under the weight of alcoholism, that she was so fragile and struggling in those times. I didn't have very much meaningful, you know, interaction with her either. So I that was really the driver, and I began to, you know, write things down, and I began to think about, okay, what would I didn't want to just leave some reflections in a journal or whatever. I really wanted to, what I really came to was I really wanted to leave something behind with them, that if I were to boil down kind of all my life lessons, not just for my life, but I counseled people in private practice, either full-time or part-time, for probably 15 years. And, you know, I've counseled thousands of people, young and old, single, married, you know, healthy, sick, you know, the whole gamut. I mean, I've professionals, very successful professionals monetarily, and people that were in an abject poverty. So I've counseled, that's lots of hours of listening and, you know, counseling with people. So I had a lot there, and I've been a CEO or an executive leader for 30 years. So I thought, you know, of all my observations from working with people, being led by others, leading others, counseling people, going through my own challenges as a kid and the life lessons I learned from that, if I were going to boil it all down and leave it behind for my kids, and it was in a document that was basically a document to say, in my opinion, I believe that these are the most important things for you to learn and build into your mindset to allow you to live your best life, to be the best steward you can of whatever God's gifts and talents and opportunities that you may have. I wrote these things down because I felt like these were the things that, frankly, I feel like everyone needs to have in their life if they're going to live their life to their fullest potential. And so, and then I said, okay, well, I'm going to give that body of information one word as the title. And so what would that be? And so the name of the book, which is not a really well-used name or a word now, but it, you know, back in the 1800s, it was more common to use this word. It's an old word. And my publisher actually said, are you sure you want to title it that? Because it's not a very well-known word. And I'm afraid people like won't understand it. And they may think it's, you know, gaming, like computer gaming or something. I said, no, I said, I want the word more than anything, because I want to reintroduce a word that I feel like has been neglected, that I think our society needs more than maybe any other word. And so the word gameness is a word, the four defining attributes for the word gameness are, to me, self-explanatory in many ways, but certainly very life-shaping words when you apply them to your life. And the first attribute is a never-quit mindset. Then the second one is resoluteness to purpose. And the third one is a fighting spirit. And the fourth one, the last one, is having the will required to act beyond your feelings. So a never-quit mindset, resoluteness to your purpose, a fighting spirit, and the will required to act beyond your feelings are the four defining attributes. So you know, that's not an exhaustive list of things that a person needs in their life to live their life to their fullest potential, but there's certainly four critical pillars, in my opinion. And so there's three chapters that follow each of those attributes, making up 12 chapters of the book. Five or six, I think, great questions at the end of those 12 chapters for discussion or personal self-reflection and application. And so I started sharing some parts of the book with my kids. I'm like, Dad, you got to, you know, share this with the public and, you know, make a book out of it. And so that's really how it began and what it's all about.
Yeah, that's great. So is there a pivotal moment when you started living some of the concepts at Gameness, looking back over your life? Talk about kind of those, maybe a couple moments where yeah, that played out.
Yeah, there were really probably several key moments for me, but I think more than anything, there was this pervasive, maybe not something I even talked a lot about as I was discovering it, but there was this pervasive awareness that I had that of what I'd gone through and the decision I had to make as to whether or not I was going to become shaped by what had happened to me or shaped by where I was going and kind of my what I might become, what's kind of the canvas that had been painted on. It's like, you know, am I going to be a victim to that and kind of always be the orphan, you know, in my mind and the way I act, the way I relate to people, and the way I don't relate to people and the way I see my life going forward, in terms of, you know, a lot of times I said, part of the transformation of, my convictions around working with at-risk families happened, when I was telling you the story a while ago about working so many years with these kids in foster care you know, I'd come home exhausted and feeling so at the same time exhausted, but noble in my efforts because it was a worthy thing. I thought, gosh, I'm helping the most hurting people in society, you know, but after I really got honest with myself, I had to ask myself, and even as a counselor, counseling all these kids, one day I remember saying to a friend of mine, I said, I really think that we have helped to these young people and even the families we're working with to become more experts of the problem and pain in their past than experts about the potential and possibilities of their future. And truly, that's a problem. And so like for myself, it was the same thing. I'm like, well, you know, Kierkegaard said, life must be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards. And so it's important, I think, for everyone, including myself, to come to an understanding of, you know, we all have family of origin, you know, issues. Maybe not so much cognitively in a way that I could talk about it, but just intuitively, I understood that what I'd gone through had impacted me deeply. And so I just had this awareness that I did not want to succumb to being defined by my past. And I wanted to live beyond that. So I think that was a big thing. I also, of course, didn't want to repeat it, you know, what had happened. But I came to a point about the time that I had that spiritual turnaround in my life when I started reading the Bible. The big aha for me then was, wow, God has a purpose for my life. That's forward thinking. That's future thinking. A destiny for me. And, you know, we all have a past. And one of the things I talk about in that first section of the book, and I talk about if I go speak at some places, you know, none of us had anything to do with getting to Earth, right? I didn't. I know you would say the same, but we're here. And we like to think we're in such control of everything. But the fact is we had not one thing to do with getting here, which is amazing to me every time I think about it. But here we are. And not only that, we had nothing to do with the family, our address, our zip code, none of the key identifying information on our driver's license, how tall we are, color of our hair, color of our eyes, height, weight. We had no control over any of that. Everything in our life happened to us from the moment we got here, and life's acting upon us. And then in our reaction to that, we began to shape a worldview, a self-perception, thoughts we have about, you know, male authority, female authority, money, God, you know, whatever it is, those views are shaped in a reactionary way to things that happened to us. And so you've got to come to a point in your life where you say, okay, the never quit mindset, that first section really is, it's really talking about upgrading your perspective. First of all, recognizing your perspective probably has been largely created by things that happened to you. And if you ever come alongside yourself and say, what do you think about all that? Do you like how you're thinking about things? And do you need to kind of clean your windshield and also use your windshield and start looking forward instead of that tiny little rearview mirror, which is important. You got to look back, be aware of what's behind you, but not, you got to live forward. So I think for me, that discovery that to kind of, I had to move beyond my past and quit letting it define me.
That's great. So thinking about kind of someone that's a leader, they're leading an organization and they've got probably baggage from, you know, their past that they're trying to navigate, and also leading others is sometimes definitely a challenge. How would somebody as a leader kind of apply some of the principles that you have and cultivate that gameness kind of in their daily life? Any things that you think would be helpful?
Well, the second section of the book to kind of leads right into it is resoluteness to your purpose. And, you know, one of the most important things for any business that's successful that I've ever seen is an organization that's not that they just have a mission, vision, and value statement in the front of their strategic plan, which has all become more of a dust collector too often than actually, you know, a roadmap that you're really using. But I don't think there's anything more important in any organization than the mission, vision, and values of the organization. But I also think that's true of people. You know, to know your why, like to really know it and to be living it intentionally, thus the word resoluteness to your purpose, unrelentingly living out your purpose. So, you know, you talk about leading organizations. One of the things I talk a lot about is really what gameness is about. Gameness is a mindset. And so the most powerful thing I think any leader can do is learn to manage their mindset, which is really the most key element in what I call self-leadership. I'm speaking to a group of leaders in June, and on leadership, it's about 110 of this organization's top leaders. And the guy that invited me, the CEO, had read my book, and he said, I want you to come kind of share some of your stories, share about gameness, though, in the workplace with my staff. And I want you to talk about leadership. And so I sent him the title of my speech. And the title of my speech is The Greatest Leadership Opportunity You've Ever, the Greatest Leadership Opportunity of Your Life. And the greatest leadership opportunity of any of our lives is learning to lead ourselves. And, you know, we have no control over the economy, the stock market, our events and circumstances that can change your board members' decisions, the business that you're working. So many things are out of our control, but we have absolute control over how we're going to respond to it. And the most important thing is cultivating a mindset of gameness that is a mindset of a never quit mindset, resoluteness to your purpose, and a fighting spirit, and the will required to act beyond your feelings. So self-leadership is, I heard a guy say recently, he said, the important thing is not to try to become a millionaire. The important thing is to work on trying to become the kind of person it takes to become a millionaire, because that means changing everything, because that means your character is going to have to be 99% better than 99% of the people in the world out there, because you're willing to, you know, make whatever changes in yourself. And I feel like the most empowering thing that I do with leaders is to help them spend some time really understanding kind of what makes them tick. Are they leading? Some people actually get into leadership because they have had in their past some sense of feel like they haven't pleased their parents, or they feel like they've been a failure in some way, or they haven't achieved something, or they want money more than anything. And they equal getting a higher promotion or a position with more money. And so, like, those are all the wrong reasons, we all know, to get into leadership. And so, one of the things that this guy, and it's the reason I'm really so busy right now, I didn't have time to commit to a speaking engagement, but the reason I accepted was his answer to my question to him. And I said, Mark, I said, his name is Mark also. I said, tell me what you think is the greatest opportunity that you see in your organization, the greatest need in your organization with your staff and your company and your business. What do you think is needed more than anything else? And I've never had anybody answer this way. He said, my greatest need is for me to grow as a person and a leader. I said, wow. I said, that's powerful. I said, I'll come speak. And that's why I made the topic of the speech what it is, because I'm going to tell his staff that day, your boss said this to me. I've never heard another guy leader tell me they felt like the greatest need in their organization is for them to become a better person and a better professional. I said, that is powerful. So for me, in terms of leadership, I think that cultivating that mindset is more important than anything else, because it creates a real solution-oriented mindset. You know, the Navy SEALs, you've heard of the Hell Week that they have. You know, when if you qualify to become a candidate, you're one of very few. And I was talking to a guy who was successful, of one of 12 out of 212 that went through Hell Week with him. And he said, I said, what was the difference in you 12 and the rest didn't? He said, well, you know, it's fascinating. He said, you could line us all up on the beach. We all looked almost just alike. We were all chiseled physically, just jacked. You know, couldn't have been no body fat anywhere on that beach. He said, we were all, you have to be in superior condition to get there. And he said, so we were there, but no matter how intelligent you had, you were and skilled with all the tools and weaponry and how good your conditioning was, all of us, when it got down to it, had a similar answer as to why we didn't go ring the bell on the beach, which is the bell you have to ring to quit and say, I'm out. And he said, it was not what you think. It wasn't like I was a little stronger. I was a little more conditioning. It had to do with their why. And he said, we stayed, we all talked about what we recalled during those toughest, darkest moments was why we signed up, why we wanted to be a SEAL, what our purpose was in being there. And even one of their teammates that was next to him that didn't want to quit, and they're begging you to not quit so they won't, and those kind of things. And so it was their why that kept them there. And I think that that's why that's so important to people in business is for leaders and their teams to really understand that their corporate mission and that they're bought into that, but also their personal one.
So talk a little bit about just some of the principles that you describe as far as in the book and some of those core foundations. Any examples of people that you've seen that have modeled that? Whether they've been mentors or people that maybe have learned from you and have applied them to their lives. Any personal stories you could share?
You know, I'll tell you this. I don't have a leader in my history that I have great respect for that didn't model all or most of those leadership components. I mean, that was their mindset, and that was probably what attracted me to it. Talking about leaders in the past, one of the reasons, I'll be real candid, one of the reasons I said no for about 5 years to my boss when he kept suggesting I become a program manager and get into the leadership track instead of the clinical side where I was counseling people. I'll just be super candid. One of the main reasons I didn't do that was because most of my bosses, this is kind of an opposite side of your question, were frankly so egocentric and authoritarian and self-centered, monetary driven. You know, it was such a turnoff to me. The people I wanted to be around least were the bosses, honestly, in my early days. Now over time that changed, and I ended up having some other bosses that, you know, weren't like that. And that really inspired me and encouraged me. You know, and I know that that without question, those attributes are the key attributes of the leaders that have had the biggest impact in my life, you know, without a doubt.
So if readers were to take one point away from your book, and if I know that's a tough question to ask, you've got a lot of great information that you share. But anything that you think would stand out if they would apply that one area, that would
be I do. Yeah, I think that I really enjoy reading about Navy SEALs and their training. And there's another quote of theirs that I really love, Mark. And it's when SEALs are dropped into a chaotic war-torn area, and they've been given an assignment, typically behind enemy lines, kind of impossible situation. They have a saying that they say to one another when they hit the ground or before they jump, and it is this, it's just powerful to me. It is, remember, we aren't here to survive this. We're here to take charge of this. And so I think the biggest point of the book is this. Every day, problems are going to get knock on your door. That's the third section of the book. Having a fighting spirit. And that means tackling your problems, not dodging them. It's that mindset. And what that means is this. Every day when adversity or problems knock on your door, and they do, small and large, one guarantee every day, you're going to have problems. So when they knock on your door, you're going to answer in one of three ways. You're going to either surrender, it means you're going to become a victim to them. Number two, I'm going to try to survive them. And that means that's not bad. It's you've got to survive before you can do what I'm going to say next. But it's survive means I'm going to keep enduring in my current situation. I'm going to keep enduring these circumstances. Okay. I'm going to hunker down. And that's a part of resilience, but that's only part of it. Resilience is a part of gameness, but you can be resilient and keep coming back every day and enduring where you are without actually having gameness, which that means subduing. So you don't surrender. You don't just survive. You subdue your problems. And that's a biblical term we don't talk a lot about. But when God created man and woman, he gives them this beautiful universe and gives us each other. And he didn't say, hey, I hope everything works out for you. I hope you do okay. And good luck. Fingers crossed for you here. There's nothing passive about what God says to mankind. And once again, it marvels me that we don't hear much conversation about this, really. He said, now go subdue every living thing. I mean, subdue the earth and take dominion of every living thing. Well, those words are like military terms. They're business management terms. They're stewardship terms. It's like, okay, here it is. Now I want you to go take responsibility for it and steward it and take charge of it, which is that the phrase by the Navy SEALs. You're not here to survive life. You're here to take charge of it. Completely different mindset. And that's what I wanted my kids to get is, you know, I had a guy text me the other day and he said, hey, how's your day going? And I said, days don't go, I go, and I'm going great. And he knows me well enough to know. And I said, hashtag gameness. And my point is, and I've tried to preach this and model this for my kids is, you know, you're not going to have any control over what's going to happen to you most days, but you have total control over what mindset you cultivate and develop, which will determine how you react to those situations. And I was reading some statistics about the time I was writing my book. I think they're still pretty current in terms of what these numbers are, but I just remember them. They just logged in my mind. There was about 10 million arrests that year. There was about 700,000 of those were teenagers. There were 1.2 million suicide attempts. Now think about the gravity of this. There was 600,000 divorces, 600,000, 250,000 more kids went into the foster care system that year. And there was the highest death rate was premature death was heart disease linked to inactivity and obesity. And like the list goes on, there were others, but I read those and I thought, that's a lot of quitting. It reminds us life is hard. And I know there's, situations where there's psychosis and there's all kinds of things in some of those numbers, but that's a lot of quitting on our life. That's a lot of quitting on relationships and our marriages. There's quitting on kids. That's quitting on society. It's quitting on our health. And the price we pay for quitting in our society and in our own personal life is epic. And so, that's why this is so important. But more importantly, it's not only that you don't want to just be resilient and not quit. You got to start there because those statistics aren't going to end unless you do at least stop the flow there. But more importantly, what if all those people went and lived their best life, lived their lives to their fullest potential? What if all those statistics I just read were people who went out and lived their life with just these four attributes, never quit mindset, discovering their purpose and living it with resoluteness, having a fighting spirit, tackling their problems, not just trying to survive them and be victims. And then lastly, having the will required to act beyond your feelings. And I'll end with this. The last section is really the most important because it's the section that you can have the other three written down, but if you don't have discipline in your life, it's just not a popular word. But it's like William James said, I'm not happy because I'm not, I don't sing because I'm happy. I'm happy because I sing. And it's us learning to act ourselves to new ways of feeling instead of trying foolishly to feel ourselves to new ways of acting. And so endorphins aren't free. You know, it takes discipline. I love what Jocko Willink said, discipline is freedom. And so I think that was the biggest lesson of all I wanted my kids to learn is that, Jesus didn't feel like dying for you. He's praying in the garden, sweating drops of blood, frustrated. His disciples aren't even over there praying for him. And he says, Father, if this cup could pass and we could go to plan B, but if not, I'll drink the cup. Your will be done, not mine. And then it said, not because he was happy and felt good about doing it. He's in deep angst over this, But he said, but for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. And so it's kind of a mindset of having the feelings required to act beyond your feelings. And that's what love's all about. It's meeting other people's needs, whether you feel like it or not. And so those are the most important lessons I wanted to get to my kids. Is kind of a, you know, I send them notes on Mondays usually, and it says TGIM instead of TGIF. You know, and it's, you know, it's just a mindset I try to cultivate with my kids. I had shoulder surgery and some other stuff that I've been dealing with. And, you know, and my son asked me, you know, how it was going, and I kind of had the same response to him. You know, you've got to cultivate that mindset, though. Otherwise, like, I feel like our society is pervasively filled with unintentionally an attitude of victimhood. I can remember counseling people in my private practice. And I talk about this in my book. And I remember my social background forms they give you when you get out of graduate school. I just kind of took them with me, and I used the same ones I used during my, you know, my residency and all that kind of stuff. And one day I was on my way home, and I was like, man, all these questions are about the pain of people's past. And people come in, and that's what they want to talk about, the pain of their past and their problems and their feelings and their this. And I added into my intake forms some questions about their future, like, what's your life purpose? What are your goals in your life right now? If you were to live your best life, what would that look like? Describe it. People literally got frustrated with me. And I would have people say, you know what? They'd call and say, hey, I think I'm doing good. I don't think I need any more sessions. And I would have some people get actually angry and say, that's not why I came in here to talk to you. I came in here to talk to you about how I'm feeling. I said, yeah, and I'm not going to talk to you anymore about that. You know, so if you want to talk about what you need to do to build a better life, I'm in. Let's go. I'll coach you. And so I think that that attitude, whether it's at work, whether it's in your own personal life or at home, is the most important mindset anybody can cultivate. And that means learning to lead yourself and manage your mindset, because you can't control everything that's going to happen at work. And if you build this into your life, you will be transformative in whatever job you get into.
Well, great. Every time I talk with you, I'm encouraged and challenged, and definitely appreciate your time taking and talking about the book, as well as kind of your life story. And encourage everybody to pick up a copy. They can get it pretty much anywhere that books are sold. And definitely want to encourage you to pick up that. Any other books that besides yours, we want to put that on everybody's list. Anything that you're reading that you would put on a leader's list?
Well, there's an old one that's that I've read many, many times, and I keep reading it. It's called The Magic of Thinking Big, by David Schwartz. You know, I think the updated version uses more up-to-date language. I get a kick out of still reading the old one and some of their examples and stuff, but it's just a classic. You know, it's just a classic book. And there's other old classics that I like to read. You know, there's a book that I like to read that I've read probably, I don't know how many times, at least 10, that is a book that I think kind of, you know, gets misinterpreted, because there's probably parts of the book that maybe not everybody agrees with, but it's Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill. Sure. But there's some nuggets in there that are really, really great nuggets. That if people apply them to their life, they're just great principles. You know, so I've read that a lot of times. You know, so those aren't new or contemporary books. But those are two, in my opinion, kind of life shaping books. For me, I've read, Win Friends and Influence People many, many times. I think it's another classic that if people haven't read it, they ought to read it. And if they've read it less than five times, they haven't read it, in my opinion. So I think those are really good books. You know, I think that of course, I didn't say this, but the most important book that I read the most is the Bible. And I think it's still the greatest leadership book there is. So those would be the ones that I would have top of mind.
Well, David, how would somebody learn more about you and some of the things that you're doing, your book,
Where's the best way for that to find out?
Yeah, like you said, you can get the book on Amazon or download it on Audible, but you can also go to the book website, gamenessleadership.com, just like it sounds. And from there, you can read a little bit about my story, my bio. I've a short bio and a long one on there on the media link, publicity link. And then you can actually download a couple of chapters from that website of the book for free if you want to check it out. And there's information about me there. And so that would be the best place.
Good. Well, again, thank you for coming back on the podcast. This has been a lot of fun. And I know it's going to be encouraging for those that are listening, and hopefully we'll light a fire on under some that that need that, and encourage them to get out there and to look forward and not stay in the rearview mirror.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. Good talking to you, Mark. I always just pray before I get on one of these conversations or podcasts or interviews, and that somebody out there that's stuck, that really needs to hear this, will hear it, and it can help move them forward, not backward, like you said.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.